Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the Book Festival. I'm Jim Dyckman. I'm an assistant professor of anthropology at Salt Lake Community College and a supporter of the Humanities Council. They've asked me to briefly introduce what's going to be happening. I am interested in this as an anthropologist, and my family's background is my grandfather was a Wobbly, a member of the One Big Union, and my companion, Judy Dyckman, had taken many oral histories of the descendants of the people involved in the killing, and they swear that Joe Hill is guilty. So we have a lot of interesting things to talk about. I have some things I need to get through, some thank yous, so if you'll bear with me. This annual Free Festival is the Utah Humanities Council gift to the community, allowing us all to explore all sorts of ideas by interacting with great writers. This year, there are 22 locations all over the state hosting over 120 book festival activities throughout October, which is National Book Month. And we hope to see you at many of them. The entire schedule is available online. We want to thank some of our sponsors. Our major sponsors, the George S. and Dolores Dore Eccles Foundation, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, Chevron, Zions Bank, as well as the National Endowment for Humanities and Arts and the Salt Lake City Zoo, Arts, and Park Fund. And, of course, thank you to our city library partners for allowing us to use these facilities. It is a pleasure to introduce and welcome our panelists who will discuss Joe Hill and radicalism in America and certainly Utah's role in the labor movement in the early 1900s. The three people that you see in front of you are a focus of a great deal of knowledge about the subject, and I just want to say something briefly about them. Bill Adler, who is bringing the book here and is the focus of the talk, has spent a great deal of time dealing with radical issues, and several of his books that you will see mentioned are important parts of that. Dr. John McCormick is Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at Salt Lake Community College, and he has published extensively in this area. And I have to be really nice to him. He's my dean, my boss in the real world. And finally, one of Utah's great people, Emeritus Professor John Sillitoe. He was at the library at the Weber State University, and his writings have also appeared in a great many places dealing with this particular subject. To allow them to begin as quickly as possible, I just want to say a couple of things about the background and have you think about these as questions. Utah, it's a very conservative state, but as you get into the discussion they're going to have, you're going to find out that this is a complex and interesting history concerning radical movements, socialism, et cetera, in Utah. And that is enough of me. I'm going to turn the time over to the panel. Please, gentlemen.
Jim, thank you. Let me explain to you what we have in mind here, and probably not so much a panel as, you know, what I've thought of as a public conversation. So, you know, just to be clear, Bill Adler at the end has written a book recently published on Joe Hill, The Man Who Never Died, The Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. It's really a wonderful book, and I was telling Bill last night when I talked to him that while other books have been written about Joe Hill, his book really advances our knowledge and the way we think about that topic, I think, in a major way. And then John Sillitoe and I have spent a major part of our lives, of our professional lives, investigating, research writing about the history of radicalism, political radicalism in Utah, in particular in the early 20th century. And that finally resulted in this book, entitled The History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. That's an abbreviated description of a newspaper account in the early 20th century of the sermons that the Unitarian minister in Salt Lake at the time, William Thurston Brown, gave. And it seemed like an appropriate subtitle for the book we wrote, which tries to, well, what it does is it surveys radical movements in Utah from the arrival of the Mormons to the present, but the bulk of the book concentrates on the Socialist Party of the early 20th century, which means there's a lot of common ground in what John and I and Bill talk about. I said to Bill last night also that I wished his book had come out before we had finished ours so that we could have used it. We could have benefited a lot from what he had to say. Yes, so and we appreciated that. So, as I say, what we have in mind is not so much a panel discussion as maybe a public conversation. That is, none of us is intending, after I get through with what I'm saying right now, to make, I think, any formal presentation or statement. What I'd like to do is begin by posing a question. And seeing how John and Bill and maybe myself might respond to that, and then just see where that leads in terms of a conversation. That is what we'd like really to have is an informal conversation between among the three of us, and also invite questions and comments from the audience. If something occurs to you as we're talking and you want to be part of the conversation, please jump in. And we want to be sure we leave time at the end for questions and comments from the audience as well. So that's what we have in mind, and we'll see how this works. So I was talking to John just a minute ago, and I thought maybe a question that might get us started is this one. We've devoted, all of us, a considerable amount of time, to investigating really political radicalism, particularly in Utah, situated within a larger context of political radical movements within the United States. We did it because we found it, at least in my case, first of all, fascinating, but second of all, important, and a neglected part of the American story. And so what John and I, and I take it Bill, have wanted to do is recover elements of the American past that have been neglected and unjustly neglected. But the response I have often got when I've talked to people about my work is that sounds maybe interesting, maybe not, but ultimately not very important. This seems like small potatoes in the larger scheme of things. That really, how important have radical political movements been in the larger scheme of things? And so I'm wondering how John and Bill might respond to that point. Interesting, but really probably not very important. Neglected, but justly, not unjustly, but justly neglected.
Take that.
Go ahead.
When I got started on researching Joe Hill, I saw it initially just as a murder mystery. I saw there were had read all the things that have been written in the past and the court transcript and everything else. And it dawned on me within a fairly short time that his murder trial was far more than a murder trial. In fact, it really wasn't even a murder trial in the larger sense. It was much more of a story that really hadn't been told, as you say, John. It was a story about us versus them. It was a story about civil society versus savage, uncivil society in the form of this radical movement, the industrial workers of the world. And I thought that was a story that had not really been told, or at least told very well in the past, that the context was missing from the Joe Hill story. And so one of the reasons I was thrilled, actually, to both read your past scholarship in Utah Historical Quarterly. Both of you had just done such pioneering work, and it was so helpful to me because it gave me the context, the initial context, that otherwise, you know, would have taken me even longer to put together, and it took me a fairly long time anyway to put together. I think it's just to tell, try to get at the truth of a story, and I think that's what, as historians, we all want to do. You need to have that context, and so I don't think you can tell any story without taking a look at the past, be it the radical past or any past. So yeah, I think it's, to me, it's something that if it had been neglected, it shouldn't be.
Well, first, let me give kudos to Bill. I thought I knew a lot about the Joe Hill case. I've been actively thinking about that case for more than 40 years. Had the pleasure of interviewing some of the people that were either directly or indirectly connected to the case. And I am just, with almost every page, literally finding things that I didn't know. And the depth of scholarship and research that Bill brings to that book is amazing. And all of us are going to understand that chapter in Utah's history so much better because of what you've done. Now, that's what you wanted me to say,
exactly.
Wasn't it? Yeah, no. The $5 is coming? No. No, seriously, it is amazing to me the kinds of things that Bill found. I have the same reaction that John and Bill both get in terms of, well, this is sort of interesting, but so what does it mean? Why is it important? Although occasionally I have people who say that, and when they find that there's nothing to be particularly ashamed of in the case of an ancestor, perhaps, or they discover that socialists stood for things that they themselves may agree with, then they find the story a little more interesting or pertinent. I'd like to think there's an unbroken line that goes from this day backward. I tell my students, historians are not the sharpest, you know, folks on the planet. They like to chop history this way because then they can get their hands around it. But in fact, history goes this way. And I submit to you that those folks over in Pioneer Park right now are part of a long continuum that goes back to the early days of Utah's history. As a part of that, what was happening in Utah in many ways, especially before World War I, but not only, but particularly before World War I, is what was happening around the country. The vote total for Debs in Utah, yeah, more or less the vote total for Debs elsewhere. The composition of the party, more or less the same as it was elsewhere, with one major exception. 40% of that party are made up of Mormons. Some active, some not so active, but nonetheless Latter-day Saints. When John and I discovered a socialist named Parley Pratt Washburn and Wilfred Woodruff Freckleton and Joseph Smith Jessup, we knew that these were not Presbyterians that we were looking at, right? That these were Latter-day Saints who brought with them their own sense of radicalism. So while we all get that, well, okay, so what kind of a question, once you can get beyond that and say the so what means these are people, as we dedicate our book, to those who sought to build a cooperative commonwealth and continue to do so today. So the connections, I think, are there, and they're strong, and they're significant.
I just want to read, if I could, one passage from your book and then ask you guys a question about it because it relates to what you were just talking about. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. This is, I won't say where it's from, but we meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized. The newspapers are subsidized or muzzled. Public opinion silenced. Business prostrate. Our homes covered with mortgages. Labor impoverished. and the land concentrated in the hands of capitalists, the fruits of the toil of millions, are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice, we breed two classes, paupers and millionaires. That's from the 1892 preamble to the Populist Party convention. And I was wondering, it's early in your book, but when you decided to include it in your book, were you thinking at all about the present?
Well, for me at least, it was hard not to think about the present, because for me as a historian, I've always said I'm not just investigating the past or concerned about the past. I'm concerned about the present and the way the past has influenced and continues to influence past and present. So my feeling, for example, is that the way you look at the past and your understanding of the past influences the way you think about the present and the future. The services to which you put the past. You can put the past in the service of a number of agendas. Present agendas. As we're talking about that point of view, I mean that radical point of view, which is saying not only do we have serious problems, but these are problems so serious that small changes within the existing system won't be enough. What we have to do is replace the existing political and economic system with a fundamentally different one. That can't help but resonate for me when I think about the present, and actually more and more when I think about the present. When we started this book, things are worse now, I think, in much worse now economically and politically than they have been for a long time when we started this book. So for me, actually, I guess, what the populists and the socialists and others were saying resonates much more, really resonates right now. I don't know, John, how you'd feel about that.
Well, I thought John was going to say, when we started this book, Lincoln was president, you know? But I wasn't sure where he was going with that. But actually, we've been doing this research for a long time, and I think you're absolutely right. Even though both of us, I think, wish this had been out a little sooner, we've had the perspective of seeing change and the turmoil of the last 30, 40 years, literally, in the process that we've been working on. And I think you quoted the Populist Party platform. There's another statement in 1908 from a Mormon socialist who essentially says a similar thing, that the world is divided between those who have and those who haven't. And he says, my political faith is socialism, though my religious faith is Mormonism. I tell my students that there are really two basic ways this country has struggled with, literally since the beginning, in terms of how you bring about change. Do you bring about it through incremental reform, or do you bring about it through revolution? Now, this is a country born out of revolution, though a pretty conservative revolution, all things considered. But at various junctions in our history, people have asked those fundamental questions. In a society that seems to be divided between a small group of people on the top who seem to have the most and the rest of us. I always say to my class the first thing, now, are there any CEOs of Fortune 500 corporations with us today? And when no hands go up, I say, well, fellow workers, I'm looking at them and so are you. And I think that, again, to harken back to something you said a minute ago, in a conservative state, you all know this is a conservative state, students thinking about that is helpful as well. Yeah.
You know, could I just read another statement, Bill, a later one? This is actually the Juab County Socialist Platform in 1908. So we're talking about a relatively small, mainly rural county in not just rural, because Eureka's there, but anyway, a county in central Utah. 1908, Juab County Socialist Platform, the present capitalist system of government, with its consequent evils of public competition and private monopolies, is productive of practically all of the poverty, suffering, and crime which makes our present society a reproach to our boasted civilization. And it went on to urge citizens to, quote, vote against a social and economic system that gives wealth to a handful of parasites, while toiling millions must content themselves with a meager and uncertain subsistence. But my question is, you know, when I read that, I said to myself, well, first of all, who wrote this, but and who was it directed toward? But what response did it meet? Well, what we find out is that the Socialist Party in Utah between 1900 and 1920 elected more than 115 socialists to public office, including a socialist member of the state legislature, more than a dozen cities and towns and counties elected socialist officials, and on seven occasions, five cities and towns had complete or predominantly socialist administration. So the town of Murray had a socialist mayor and city council in 1911 and 1915, and the city of Eureka did, and on and on and on. We find that the State Federation of Labor on three occasions officially endorsed the Socialist Party and urged its members to vote for socialists. So when we begin pointing things like, so going back to my original question, you know, how do we respond to someone who says, well, really, how important is this aspect of Utah and U.S. history? When we begin pointing those things out, that it's not just that, you know, a group of people is saying this kind of stuff, but they're meeting a response, and that response is resulting, they're meeting a positive response in a whole range of ways, that, you know, over 100 socialists are elected to office, the State Federation of Labor endorses the party, a total of nine socialist papers were published throughout Utah during this period of time. The Ogden newspaper, Salt Lake or Utah's largest city, for a five-year period, had a socialist column every Sunday in their paper that probably, you know, that reached a wide audience. When we begin pointing those things out, then sometimes people I talk to say, well, actually, maybe there was something going on that I hadn't even thought about, because that doesn't correspond to my view of Utah as not only so conservative, but presumably always conservative. You know, maybe the history of Utah is much more complex and interesting than I originally thought.
Yeah. Well, and one of the interesting things that you could talk about, Bill, if you would, is the way that Joe Hill captures that and the mechanisms he uses to disseminate the IWWI ideology, you know, cartoons and music and that sort of thing, which kind of feeds into this whole contextual thing.
I would like to talk about that, but I can't let... I wanted to talk about Murray, Utah for a second, too, since you mentioned it, and it's socialist office holders. When Joe Hill was arrested for murder in January of 1914, he was arrested by the socialist police marshal. Is that right? Yeah. Peters, and he was arrested because 2 days earlier he had gone to see a doctor in Murray, Dr. Frank McHugh, for the gunshot wound he received through his chest, and then a day after McHugh treated him, Governor William Spry posted a $500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators of the murder of John Morrison and his son Arling. So Frank McHugh called Chief Peters, Marshal Peters, and turned in Joe Hill. Well, Frank McHugh was a prominent socialist as well. I wanted to ask both of you. I know, and Dr. McHugh's wife, Olivia, also, who you've written about, also was a prominent socialist. And so it seemed in the larger scheme of that the Wobblies and the Socialist Party were often at odds, and I think it's just important to draw that distinction, that not every radical in Utah was on the same page at the same time.
Although they all kind of rallied to Joe's defense.
They did later, yeah.
But there were real differences of opinion between the, you know, the electoral approach of the Socialist Party and the direct action approach of the IWW, yeah. I had the opportunity to talk to Olivia McHugh. I was a much, much younger man, and she was a much, much older woman. And I said to her, "Why do you think Joe chose your husband?" And she said, "Well, two reasons. He'd seen him around Murray and knew him. And I think he thought he wouldn't charge him." So he didn't charge him, but it was...
Yeah, Joe paid.
Joe paid, yeah.
Well, that's, I think, an interesting point. That is, it's important not to talk about radicals, whether they're socialists or wobblies or anarchists. I mean, there was an anarchist presence in Utah or whatever as a unified group. You know, they certainly weren't. And there were plenty of divisions between them, which really complicates, I think, the story and the challenge. One of the challenges is what to make of that. John and I think, ran up against that when we one thing we did is we examined socialist rhetoric, and in the book we have a chapter about that, and really quite wonderful rhetoric. And, you know, one of the basic points that is, you know, what does socialists say? What appeals did they make? To whom did they address their rhetoric? You know, what did they kinds of things did they say and write to try to rally people to the cause? And it's really, you know, sometimes very direct and damning, and sometimes eloquent. I mean, the title of the chapter we wrote on rhetoric is the subtitle, "The Destruction of Love is the Very Genius of the Competitive System." The point they were making is that capitalism doesn't just cause inequality and poverty and oppression, etc., etc. It really is an unethical system that divides people against each other and makes it very hard to behave in an ethical way. You know, they go on, you know, there's some very, really very wonderful elaborations of that statement. So then we looked at what socialists did when they were actually in office and had a chance to do something. So when you're elected the city treasurer as a socialist of Cedar City, and you're the only socialist, you don't have a chance to have much impact. But when you're in Murray and the mayor and the city council are socialists, now you got a chance to do something. What do you actually do? And what we found is that they actually acted pretty conservatively. They acted as respectable reformers, I think we say. They were interested in showing that they could administer city government in an efficient, honest, non-corrupt way. They busied themselves with all the routine of administering a city, and in fact, they explicitly resisted going any further. And so when there's a strike in 1912 of smelter workers, they don't support the smelter workers. They support the police against the smelter workers who are going out on strike. And so our question, so what we conclude from there in that chapter is that maybe the reason the Socialist Party ultimately failed, because it did, I mean, it was a significant presence for 20 years and then it phased, maybe they weren't radical enough. That is, they were radical in rhetoric but not in action, and maybe finally that's what led them to fade away.
Yeah. And they clearly weren't radical enough for the wobblers. Yeah.
Right, right. Their concentration on electoral reform was at complete odds with the Wobblies, who didn't believe in parliamentary action whatsoever. Or they were completely involved with direct action in at the point of production, as they put it, anything else was considered just tinkering with the machinery and did no good at all, they felt.
Yeah. One of the interesting stories is when Fred Peters comes to arrest Joe Hill. He makes a move for a bandana, and Peters shoots him in the hand, and it's bad. He almost dies. has pneumonia and one thing or another. Anyway, when he is sentenced and they give him the choice of being shot or hung, he says, oh, I've been shot a couple of times lately. I think I can deal with it one more time. He's an amazing person that I don't fully understand. I'm understanding better as a result of reading your book, but the question that I usually get, and you probably get it too, is, okay, was he guilty? And I say, I don't know, he said he wasn't. But I don't know beyond that. How do you answer that, Bill, when people ask you that?
Well, now I say I think he was almost certainly innocent. I mean, I don't know that I could prove it in a court of law. It's a little tough a century later, and it is really a cold case. But I did find out some new and interesting things about the murder case. Number one, when the murders were committed, that was on a Saturday night, and the following day's papers, the Sunday morning papers, all attributed the killing to revenge. They said that was the motive, that was what the police had said, and they had a guy in mind. They had a suspect, a guy they knew as Frank Z. Wilson. But nobody really had looked into Frank Wilson before, and I thought, he'd been detained that night. He'd been seen around the crime scene, the Morrison store, within a mile of the crime scene. He had been seen acting, quote, strangely, an hour and a half or so after the murders. And then he shows up right at the store. He's wandering around without an overcoat, and it's a freezing January night. Looking disheveled and didn't give coherent answers to a couple of questions about where he lived and where he worked and so forth. And then he found a bloody handkerchief in his pocket the next day after they had detained him. So it seemed to me that, but then they let him go when they arrested Joe Hill. And I wanted to know why they let him go in the first place, because they had been looking for him. And in fact, when they arrested Joe Hill, they initially thought, according to one police sergeant, that Hill had given a phony name, that actually Joe Hill was Frank Z. Wilson. So I wanted to look into Wilson. And he was a hard guy to look into because, for one thing, it wasn't his name. He had on the order of 16 aliases, at least I counted up to 16. His real name was Magnus Olsen, it turned out, and he had been born in Denmark. Hill was from Sweden, of course. So they shared similar background. Both were about 6 foot one. They weighed the same kind of body type, fair hair, blue eyes. So it could have been a case of mistaken identity. I don't know. But I do know that the man they knew as Frank Wilson was a career criminal, that he had been on a crime spree at the time. That he had been on the spree for a long time, that he'd done time in many states already, that he'd done 12 months in the Utah penitentiary for armed robbery in 1911 and 12, and that he was a bad actor. And so he seemed to me like a more likely suspect, one they probably should have pursued, and they didn't. But they didn't know a lot about his background, I think, other than his stint in the Utah penitentiary, but they didn't bother to investigate it either. Then the other piece of information that made me think that Hill was innocent or likely innocent was a letter that I came upon that was written many years later. It was written in 1949, so 34 years after Hill's execution. And it was written by a woman named Hilda Erickson. And Hilda Erickson was mentioned at the time of Hill's trial and execution every once in a while in the press because she was the niece of two brothers with whom Joe Hill had been staying when he got to Utah and where he was on the night he was arrested and shot by Marshall Peters. And Hilda, according to herself, had been engaged to marry Joe's close friend, Otto Appelquist, a fellow Swede. And Appelquist and Joe Hill had met one another at the port in Southern California, the Los Angeles Harbor. And they had also met those two brothers from here, the Aselius brothers from Murray. And after the Wobblies were blacklisted at the port in Los Angeles due to a failed strike there, They no longer had a way to make a living, to work as longshoremen. And so these two Aselius brothers came back to Murray, and they invited Otto and Joe to follow them. Otto went first, and it was then sometime in the spring or very early summer of 1913 that he met their niece, Hilda Erickson. And they fell in love and were engaged to marry. And then Joe got here sometime in August of 1913. And sometime after that, I think he fell for Hilda Erickson as well. Anyway, long story, fairly short. On that evening of January 10th, 1914, when the Morrisons were murdered, according to Hilda, Joe and Otto got in a scuffle about Hilda because Hilda had broken off her engagement to Otto shortly before that. And Joe Hill, who was naturally kind of a taunting, teasing guy, was apparently ribbing Otto that Hilda liked Joe better than she liked Otto, and that's why she broke it off. Well, in a fit of anger, according to Hilda Erickson, he shot Joe Hill through the chest. And as Hilda also said, he felt immediately bad afterwards and apparently dropped Hill off at Dr. McHugh's house. So based on that evidence and based on the evidence that I uncovered about this Frank Z. Wilson, it seemed to me much more likely that Wilson was the perpetrator of the crime, and in any event, that Joe Hill was innocent of that crime. There are many other things, but those are kind of two bits of important evidence.
You know, one thing John and I were interested in, and one thing I really appreciated about your book is that one thing we're asking ourselves is, okay, what were radicals up against? That is, what were people who were challenging the system in calling for fundamental change, and characterizing the economic and political social system in the ways they did? What were they up against? What response, what opposition did they meet, and what forms did that opposition take? And we try to spell that out in a range of ways, particularly in the last couple of chapters of the book. But it seemed to me in reading your book that regardless of whether he was innocent or not, and like you say, it's maybe at this point really hard to tell, although it seems to me more than any other book, you present evidence that more strongly suggests that he was innocent. But it also seemed to me that he clearly got a his trial was flawed. He was convicted on circumstantial evidence. I think I might say he did not get a fair trial. So then the reasons he got the kind of trial he did and the proceedings went the way he did, not only the trial but the appeals and so forth, tells you something, it seems to me, about what radicals were up against. So could you say something about that in your view? You know, what was the nature of the opposition they faced? Any radical, Joe or anyone else?
Well, the opposition was widespread and really blanketed against radicals at that point. And I will address that. But one of the things about your book that was so helpful to me in your past writings was your description of this Tucker strike in Utah in the summer of 1913, because it immediately preceded Hill's arrest, and it was a time of great tension between the IWW and the state of Utah, but not only the state, and that's what I think came into play in Hill's trial. It was an oligarchy. I mean, it was the press, it was the courts, it was the prosecutor, I mean, the judge as well, and the police. And not that it was necessarily a conspiracy. It didn't have to be a conspiracy, I think, because it was understood, as I said at the beginning, that this was us versus them, and this was really making an important point and trying to oust this radical presence from the state. And I think the trial and the subsequent execution consequent execution, were as much about that, about ridding the state of this this venomous enemy, as it was, as it had anything to do with the particular facts of the case, which, John, as you say, were I mean, they were circumstantial evidence, but it was so flimsy as to be, you know, I think had he been tried, had he had decent counsel, for one thing, he would have gotten off. I don't think the case would have ever gone to trial, but that it did go to trial, had he had decent counsel, it should have been over.
You know, one reason I asked the question, please jump in, John,
sure.
is that one of the things we've said, you know, in many of the things we've written, that whether it's about radical subjects or not, is that when you write about Utah history, you can't ignore the fact and presence and influence of the Mormon Church. I mean, one thing that makes Utah different from many other states that are similar in other ways is the presence of the Mormon Church. So you always have to ask, what role does the Mormon Church play? And what we found is that from the time of its beginnings, the Mormon Church, even though we argue in the book that early Mormons were utopian socialists, they were socialists of a kind. They weren't Marxian socialists, and they weren't talking about class struggle, but they were utopian socialists trying to establish their version of a cooperative commonwealth. Even so, you know, from the beginning, they were also opposed and said so very directly to socialist, other socialist groups, and that opposition, I guess, intensified and took new forms in the late 19th, early 20th century as the radical presence increases. So, for example, just one statement this is from George Q. Cannon, who was, I think, the second counselor in the Mormon Church's first presidency and probably, you know, maybe the most influential member of that group. In an 1894 address at the Salt Lake Tabernacle, he says, "We advise church members to let socialism severely alone, indeed to reject all radical economic and political philosophies," which he identified as among the secret combinations that God had warned his people against in the Book of Mormon. Radical movements, he said, are not just schemes, but have come directly from Satan and thus were evil, seeking to destroy government, to overturn existing institutions, to array class against class, community against community. They're among the catastrophes that God has said would occur in these latter days. Those days were at hand, he said, the millennium would arrive, but current difficulties, including political radicalism, would have to be eliminated before the millennium would arrive. Therefore, he said, quote, "Our constant effort is to keep our people from joining those organizations." That's such a powerful statement made on a public occasion and circulated in many ways that I guess I found myself surprised that any Mormon would become a socialist. And as John said, we found that, you know, over 40% of socialists in Utah were Mormons, many of them active Mormons. But the point is that for me at least, there was a significant radical presence, and it included many Mormons in the face of that kind of opposition from a dominant presence in the state.
It took great courage, I think, to do what some of those socialists, those Mormons, did. And the one person I'm thinking of, and I know, John, you've written about her, is Virginia Snow Stephen, whose father was a former president of the church. And in 1914, at Hill's trial, she stood up. She was then an art instructor at the university, and stood up and basically raised the money for Joe Hill's appeal. and was one of his most active supporters and spokespersons, for that matter, in Hill's defense. And she suffered a great backlash. Could you talk about that a little bit, John?
Yeah, she lost her job and was pretty well shunned at the University of Utah. She was also involved with Emma Goldman during that period of time. She's a fascinating figure. And one of the nice things that came out of even though our books didn't come out early enough to really use them in each case, because of the interactions that we had with Bill and vice versa, Bill found a wonderful letter that we were able to use that talks about Virginia Snow Stephen later. She married an organizer for the IWW, and they moved to Northern California, and they lived there for many, many years. And so it came at a personal cost for many people. Virginia Snow Stephen would be one of those folks. Others, that what you raised a minute ago, the point you raised a minute ago is very true. The climate of opposition is as intense and strong as one might imagine. You know, when they arrest Joe Hill, and if I remember correctly, they asked the police chief in San Pedro about him, he says, "You've got the right man." Now, he doesn't say, "You've got the person that committed the crime." He said, "You've got the right man." One less wobbly in the world will be a better place. Bishop Paul Jones of the Episcopal Church is a Christian socialist, an important part of the socialist coalition. Those people who say they want to separate the rule of gold from the golden rule. He is forced out of his position because he is a socialist and an opponent of World War I. And the Episcopal community is not going to have their bishop a radical.
In that particular case, Bishop Jones, one of the is Board of Advisors of the Episcopal Church,
Council of Advisors.
Council of Advisors, thank you, was Joe Hill's judge,
right.
Morris Ritchie. And Morris Ritchie was not pleased with Bishop Jones's outspoken support for Joe Hill and against the death penalty.
Yeah, and once the United States finds itself in war, then that's a Rubicon that needs to be crossed. The labor movement, while it endorses the Socialist Party on various occasions, it is a conservative force too. And there's an anti-socialist element in the labor movement of Utah as well. So understanding that intensity, Phil Foner says, quotes a story in one of his early books about the Utah Construction Company. I knew my worlds were meeting one day at Weber State. We have the records of Utah Construction Company. And I was working on those while I got a phone call from a guy named Franklin Rosemont, who wrote an early book about Joe Hill and wobbly culture. And I knew my worlds were colliding here. But the Tucker strike was against Utah Construction. And according to Foner, one of the officials said, "Okay, you won this battle. But we're going to win the war here, pal. Watch out. We're going to break the union." And so that intensity of opposition is strong, and take no prisoners. I don't think most people that November 20th day in 1915 that woke up and read the Salt Lake Papers, I don't think most people felt like that justice hadn't been served. Now, whether they knew anything about the case or not, they felt like this was probably something that should have happened. And obviously, many people said, if you were innocent, you would tell us who the woman was. And Joe Hill always said, maybe he was an optimist, maybe, I don't know, but he always said, "I do not have to prove my guilt, my innocence, you have to prove my guilt." The guy I did my master's thesis on, Parley P. Christensen, was asked by the governor. The governor said, "Go out to the prison and just get this guy to say he's guilty and I'll commute his sentence." And Hill told him, "I'm not going to say I'm guilty of something I didn't do. And if I am executed in the process, that's your problem. But I'm not going to proclaim guilt when I'm innocent." Well, that's a fascinating guy.
I think that was part of it. He was stubborn to the point of recklessness and principled.
Yeah.
As well, and I think the other reason he never disclosed who shot him and why, the circumstances of that gunshot wound, were because during the 22 months that he was in prison, the IWW began this and organized this worldwide campaign to try to get Hill a new trial, or at least get his sentence commuted from death to life, or pardoned. He wasn't going to take the pardon or commutation, as John just said. He said new trial or bust. He was ready, and only for that. But I think he began to see himself, as others saw him, as this icon of working class resistance and rebellion and conviction. And I think once he began to see himself in that light, I think he was kind of backed into a corner. The IWW, at one point, one member wrote in the pages of the Industrial Worker, or rather Solidarity, one of the two weekly papers, said, you know, this is hard on Joe Hill, but it's good public relations for the IWW. And I think she was right. It brought them worldwide attention, and it also brought him this real level of pressure, I think, that he had a hard time backing away from. And I think in the end, that's one reason he decided to become a martyr.
One other quick thing about that, and he's such an amazing, colorful. I say to people, I don't know if there's a hereafter or not, but if there is, there are three Joes I want to talk to. Joe Smith's on that list, Joe Stalin's on that list, and Joe Hill's on that list. And when he is about to be executed, he says to the IWW, please arrange to have my body thrown over the Wyoming line. I don't want to be found dead in Utah. Some of us may understand that from time to time. On another occasion, he says, he's off to Mars to organize the canal workers. Don't mourn for me, he says, organize. And somewhere that line was crossed, and he realized his value, guilty or innocent, his value to the Union was something that transcended the specifics of the case, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think his whole case transcended the specifics of the case. yeah, but I think you're right. He realized, he saw his death as a means to an end, to the liberation of the working class, and he thought he could do much more value as a martyr than he could alive writing songs in prison.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning we said we'd like to open things up for questions or comments from the audience. And I'm sorry we haven't left more time to do that, but I think we have about 10 minutes if we'd like to do that. And I take it there's someone with a microphone, so let's see about that.
Yeah, we've got the mics here. Remember, we're live, and we'll take some time. And panel, thank you.
Even more puzzling to me is why didn't Hilda Erickson come forward in 1914? I mean, she could have prevented this, you know, miscarriage of justice. And why 35 years later? What do you think her motivation was for staying silent for so long?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I wish I did. I know that she and Joe Hill met weekly during the entire time that he was imprisoned. And I know also that during his trial, Joe and Hilda were granted a 15-minute private session in the judge's chambers, during which I suppose, but I don't know for sure, that they discussed whether or not he was going to testify, or whether she would testify for that matter. And I believe that he asked her to keep his confidence, and I don't know why. As far as why she wrote the letter 35 years later, she wrote it in response to a researcher's question, and I think at that point maybe she just felt like she was getting on in years, and she wanted to set the historical record straight. But again, this is speculation. I don't have – I mean, she doesn't say why she wrote the letter in that letter. But I also can't think of a reason that she wouldn't be telling the truth all those years later.
I worked with a Sam Morrison at Kennecott's power plant. In fact, Sam was one of – at one time was one of the – board members of our local union, IBW 1438, and he was related. I don't remember his relationship, but he was related to the Morrison family and the two that were murdered. And Sam was convinced that Joe Hill was guilty, which I find rather ironic.
Well, I would have been too. I mean, after all, he was convicted, and the family never had any other information to suggest somebody else might have been guilty or that Hill was innocent. So I have spoken and interviewed for the book two of John Morrison's grandchildren, one of whom came last night. I gave a talk in Park City, and she was there. And she seems receptive, actually, to the idea that perhaps someone else might have committed the crime. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make her family history any easier to take, but she seems open to that, which I thought was quite interesting.
You know, and by all accounts, John G. Morrison and Arlie Morrison were wonderful people, hardworking people, and clearly they died in January of 1914. Whether Joe Hill was the guilty party or not, they were killed. And that impacted that family in immeasurable ways. I knew Merlin Morrison, the other boy that was there, when he was probably 80. And it was still as fresh in his memory the time I interviewed him as it was that evening. And I don't know how a family could go through that and not have that. You know, there's another guy that we sometimes forget, a guy named Roy Horton, who's murdered in the streets of Salt Lake simply because he is an IWW agitator and he's killed by a former cop who gets off. This, you know, there's a lot of violence these days, but there was some violence back in the day as well. And there are a lot of people who suffered during that. And so I'm not surprised your friend, despite labor solidarity, thought he was guilty. My late wife said to me, "Just another con." And that was her way of dealing with Joe Hill. "Just another con." Well, I said, "I think, Linda, it's a little more complicated." She didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, I was just wondering about Frank Wilson. Okay, you said he spent time in the penitentiary here. I was wondering if there's an overlap between Morrison's time as a police officer and his time being arrested, Frank Wilson, at the penitentiary, if you've researched any of that, because obviously it seemed like a revenge killing, too. There was a comment made during the holdup and all.
Right. No, there was no revenge. There was no crossover. Morrison was a police officer for just a brief time, for something on the order of 11 months. But he mainly was a grocer. He had been a grocer. He heroically fought off a would-be robber in 1903, and then a few years later, he was appointed a police officer for a short time during the reign of the American Party here. But after that time ended and a police chief was deposed, George Sheets, Morrison stepped down as a police officer well before 1911. There was another officer who arrested Frank Wilson. So no, there was no crossover. But there was, the revenge question is interesting because 4 months before John Morrison was murdered, there was an attempted robbery. He had left his store also on a Saturday night, was on the way home, and some assailants held him up. And he fought them off with a gun, and he fired some shots. He had night blindness, so he wasn't sure if he hit anybody. But he said at that time, in September of 1913, that he feared people were going to come back and get him and that they didn't want his money, they wanted his life.
And it's erroneously reported in the press that Wilson and Morrison had crossed paths when he was a cop. The other interesting thing, according to all the testimony that I'm familiar with, correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently what the masked men said is, "We've got you now." They didn't say, "Open the safe, give us your money." They said, "We've got you now," which sure sounds like revenge to me. Yeah,
in 1914, they were able to create a world network without Twitter or the Internet or anything like that. Two-part question. Who in the 21st century do you think would come close to the charisma or the public awareness of Joe Hill? And second, how do you think organization in 2011 would occur around a political or social issue?
Interesting.
I just want to address one part of that, and then I'm going to ask these guys to deal with it. But I don't think Joe Hill was all that charismatic, for one thing. He was a pretty taciturn guy. He didn't speak a lot, and he expressed himself mainly through his music and his writing. This charisma was part of what I was talking about before. I think people projected a lot onto him that wasn't necessarily there. I mean, he was a fascinating guy. I just don't think he was a charismatic guy, at least in the sense that I think of somebody with charisma. Do you guys want to handle her?
Well, I agree with that. I don't think he was personally charismatic, but he had the ability to understand PR kinds of things in a way that most people did not. In one of his songs, he talks about getting pie in the sky when you die, and that phrase entered the lexicon, and we still talk about it. The whole don't mourn, organize, the whole haul me to the Wyoming border, all of that sort of thing. He was uneducated in a strictly going to school sense, but a pretty smart operator. Personally charismatic, I don't think he was either. I agree with that. I think, and maybe partly it was English as a second language that was part of that. He's just a common worker. In many ways, I think he was a common worker who came to America hoping to find a new life and became disillusioned with what he found. And maybe that's why he was willing to become a martyr. I don't know. Who is like him today? Boy, I don't know. Che Guevara, capturing the public attention from people who don't really understand his ideology particularly, but he is so romantic a figure. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know either. I'm trying to think about that. And I wish I could think of someone and could feel more optimistic than I often do about the possibility of addressing in useful, fruitful ways, you know, the overwhelming problems that we face right now. Although I don't think, maybe it's a mistake. Here's another thing. Maybe it's a mistake to focus too much on individuals as the salvation. You know, we talked about the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King, and, you know, as I've often said, as important as Martin Luther King was, you know, he led a movement. People responded to him. Things would have been a lot different if tens of thousands of people had not been willing to do the things they did, to undertake nonviolent mass resistance. Martin Luther King led a movement, but he was a product of a movement as well, and that's what I think it's going to take. It's going to take people coming together. People coming together and in a way, you know, that will require enormous commitment, I mean, and sacrifice. What I was going to say a minute ago is that I think all of us were impressed by the sacrifice it took for a Joe Hill or a William Thurston Brown or a Murray King or a Henry W. Lawrence or a Virginia Snow Stephen or a Olivia McHugh or whatever, you know, to do what they did. I've often asked myself, what does it take for someone to devote themselves to a cause, not just briefly, not just for a month or even a year, but for a lifetime?
And more than that, I mean, Hill asked himself that, you know, that question, if a cause is important enough to live for, is it also worth dying for? And his answer, I think, had a lot to do with, you know, with the fact that he did become a legend.
And for me, things always get complicated because I also read someone recently, I can't remember who it was now, who said it's one thing to die for a cause, but they thought it was much harder to figure out a way to live for that cause, so that you're devoting your entire life to it. And that, they were saying, was the real challenge, living for a cause in a committed, principled way.
Let me just add quickly, because I know we're about out of time, but I think Joe Hill understood that, and one of the characters he creates is a guy named Mr. Block. And Mr. Block is just a dumb worker. His head is solid lumber and big as a rock, he says. And Block, he thinks he may be president someday. And I think Joe Hill was saying, come on, it is the struggle of the working class that will bring this about. If it's going to come about, not a charismatic leader, not necessarily a union even, but the collective struggle of ordinary people. Like I say, there are three Joes. I want to hear the story from firsthand.
Well, thank you, panelists. We've run out of time. Well, again, thank you for joining us here with the Utah Humanities Book Festival. We hope you will stay and enjoy all of the programs we've got here, and you can get information up at the table. We are interested in your feedback, which helps to plan future events, so if you've been invited to fill out a survey form or would like to, please do that for us. You can check with one of the volunteers. If you're interested, and they're great books, in buying a book, you can kind of exit either of the doors down here and have them autograph for yourselves. And we would again like to thank you for coming and appreciate your attendance. Thank you. Thank you.